Hello, I'm Alistair Benn, Reaction's Deputy Editor and host of the Reaction podcast. This is a special edition featuring an interview with Professor John Curtis, one of Britain's leading experts on elections. The polling guru is central to the BBC's coverage of general elections, and his media appearances have made him one of the country's most trusted commentators. On election night next month, he will be at the heart of the story, as Britain awaits the exit poll at 10 p.m. and then the verdict of the voters. He joined Reaction's editor Ian Martin for an event for our readers last Wednesday. Here's what he had to say.
So, John, you've covered a lot of elections.
Yeah, 1979, this is the 40th year, yeah.
Where does this one stand compared to the others? How important is it?
Well, yes, okay. In terms of importance, it clearly is at least as important as any other election. I mean, arguably... Yeah, I know, okay. It's an obvious statement. Well... I mean, 1979 proved to be an important election, but as it were, that only became obvious with hindsight. This is an election whose importance, I think, is clear in advance, in that the parliamentary shenanigans and manoeuvrings of the last 6 months have perhaps accidentally got us to a point where perhaps we're finally going to make a decision about the EU, and this general election may not necessarily make the final decision, but it's certainly going to determine an important pathway because, as I think people are now cottoning on, is that this election is essentially a binary choice so far as Brexit is concerned. Either Boris Johnson gets an overall majority, in which case he should be able to get the withdrawal treaty through by the 31st of January, although the House of Lords may make life a little bit difficult, and is at least has a mandate to negotiate whatever future relationship with the European Union he wishes to achieve. And so long as he can keep his party on side on that, then he should be able to achieve what he wants to achieve. So that's one outcome. The other possible outcome, apart from a very, very narrow range of results, is that we end up with a hung parliament. And in a hung parliament, because the Conservatives have run out of friends, and because all of the opposition parties, apart from the DUP, are in favour of a second referendum, and indeed, why did we end up having an election? Because both the Liberal Democrats and the SNP came to the conclusion that they weren't going to get a second referendum out of the old parliament, and they're hoping to get one out of the new one. So one has to anticipate that in the event that the number of pro-second referendum MPs is greater than the number of the Conservative, and certainly Conservative, the number of DUP MPs, that in the end some kind of minority Labour administration will be put in office charged with the task of holding a second referendum, so we'll have another extension, we'll have a referendum, which should presumably finally resolve the issue, though in what direction it will resolve the issue is still highly uncertain, because although Remain has a lead in the polls, it's a very small lead and certainly not something you'd want to put too much money on. But I think the point is that whichever direction we now go, we seem to be on a pathway that means we will finally have made a decision of some kind or another.
And are you discounting the possibility of a Labour overall majority?
For all practical purposes, yes. Though, of course, you know, the honest truth is, in terms of the decision made about Brexit, the difference between a hung parliament and a majority Labour administration is a relatively small one, other than that a majority Labour administration would reckon it had the mandate to try and go off and negotiate another deal with the European Union, though, of course, what Labour calls a credible leave deal for most leave voters would be an incredible leave deal. And to that extent, at least, you know, it's not obvious how it would frame a referendum that really would finally sort out what we wanted to do. But apart from that, I mean, I think the point is, you know, it's either Boris or nothing. And it doesn't, on other issues, clearly the prospect of a majority Labour administration is, you know, matters. But on Brexit, probably not.
So anyone wanting a second referendum or wanting to delay Brexit needs to hope for a hung parliament, really, and vote accordingly.
Yeah, and I think the point is that the subtleties of different kinds of hung parliaments, which now potentially matter to a degree, but at the end of the day, the big thing is, Are there enough pro-second EU referendum MPs to outvote Boris Johnson or not? That's the big thing. Then, obviously, within that, it would be easier for the Labour Party to run an administration if they only had to rely on the SNP, as well as the SNP and the Democrats, etc., etc. But, you know, that is a, you know, a variation on a clear central theme, which is a hung parliament, except for a very narrow range of results, clearly points towards a second referendum, and that beyond that, it's subtlety. So, I mean, I think the point about this, you know, if one takes the view that the decision to leave or otherwise the European Union is indeed one of the biggest public policy decisions this country has made since 1945, and given that it seems now to be clear that this general election is going to set a pathway that will eventually lead finally to a choice, then this is an election which in advance at least is clearly important and which is going to have important implications for the future direction of this country, whichever side of the argument you're on. Whereas, sure, 1979 in the end mattered, but we didn't know in 1979 what the implications were necessarily going to be in the way that I think we can anticipate with this election what it looks as though the implications are likely to be. And meanwhile, you know, 1997, I would argue, perhaps in some senses, well, I mean, the 1997 election night was the most exciting election night simply because of that sight of Conservative MPs losing their seats in the way that people didn't anticipate, you know, which was summed up by Michael Portillo's.
Well, I was just going to say it wasn't very exciting for Michael Portillo.
No, it wasn't. But it was for those people for the rest of us. You know, with all due apologies to Michael. But you know, I mean, I well remember on. You know, I mean, as you know, I mean, I spent years sitting, you know, on BBC election night, you know, doing the sophology, trying to work out what's going on, and I well remember, you know, kind of in the middle of the night, you know. And I had a BBC producer next to me whose job is to kind of keep on prodding me and saying, have you got any lines? And I said, look, sit down, shut up. We're not going to get anything on air for the next 90 minutes. This is just sheer human drama as you saw the Tories fall. And it's partly, of course, the drama, of course, was also because nobody believed the polls in 1997. Yeah. They couldn't possibly believe that Tony Blair was going to win by a landslide. Some of us thought, you know what, yes, he is going to win by a landslide. And but you know, because of that backdrop, the drama was heightened as to what was going on. And that's going to be a difficult night of drama to repeat. I mean, not even, you know, I mean, if in 2017 Amber Rudd had lost her seat,
yeah,
then we would have had an iconic moment which would have illustrated you know, Theresa May's failure to get a majority. But we didn't have an iconic moment in 2017. So although it was important and it surprised people, it didn't have the same human dramatic theatre.
But you could, in this contest, you could see, presumably, because of the strange nature of the contest, the way in which the country's divided, leave,
yeah,
remain.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, we'll come back to Scotland, leave, yeah, Scotland for a second.
Yeah.
But it's then divided in interesting new ways regionally. It is presumably going to produce some individual results, some rather famous people losing in surprising fashion.
Perhaps. I mean, but I mean, I think people do. I mean, the first thing you have to remember is that 2017 has already fundamentally changed the electoral geography of much of the country, and certainly fundamentally changed the character of the Conservative vote. So, you know, the Conservative Party in 2017, its vote went up by 15 points amongst those people who voted Leave, and it went down by 8 points amongst Remainers. So the electorate that Theresa May got in 2017 was markedly different in character from the one that David Cameron had in 2015, which gave him his narrow majority, which started this whole process.
Yeah.
And the same is also true of the electoral geography. The Conservatives actually recorded a net swing in the most pro-Leave parts of the country while doing very bad in the most Remain parts, like much of the area around this building. That does help to explain, because people are going around saying, how could Bishop Auckland possibly elect a Tory MP? It's not complicated. It's because Bishop Auckland has already swung to the Tories at the last election. This is Theresa May's legacy to Boris Johnson. So these seats have. So that's a product.
So there was a swing, but she obviously
didn't win.
Didn't get far enough.
The point is, the seats moved to the Tories against the tide, making them marginal, which is why they now look winnable. All right. So the point is that. So what you have to remember is the baseline geography we already have has already baked into it, particularly so far as the Conservatives are concerned, a different electoral geography. So although it is true that even now the Conservative vote is higher amongst Leave voters than it was in 2017, while it is at present still lower amongst Remain voters than it was in 2017, you shouldn't necessarily expect a dramatic change, further change in electoral geography, because it's already quite heavily baked into the baseline. Yeah. So I'll put it slightly differently. The Tories don't actually need to make much ground in Bishop Auckland. It's simply all they need to hope is the Labour vote goes down a bit, and bingo, they're home and dry, right?
Mm-hmm.
That said, there is clearly a party. Quite how they're going to play out is highly uncertain. And I think if the surprises are going to happen, it's there. And that's the Liberal Democrats. Because the character of the Liberal Democrat vote is not only different from 2017, it's very different from anything we have seen before for the Liberal Democrats.
So how would you characterise it? Well, I mean, they seem to be slipping in the polls, yeah, but sure. They seem to be doing very well in concentrated areas.
Sure, but the point about Liberal Democrats is that all of the increase in their support since 2017, literally all of it, has occurred amongst Remain voters. The Liberal Democrats can now be regarded as obverse Brexit, OK? Their support is almost as pro-Remain as Nigel Farage's is almost universally pro-Brexit, OK? Now, the implications of that, the potential implications of that were, for example, illustrated in the European Parliament election, which, of course, they did very well and got 20% of the vote. But just think about it. Historically, the Liberal Party and more recent Liberal Democrats have been the party of the Celtic fringe. So they get seats in the north of Scotland, they get some seats in Wales, they get seats in the southwest of England. More recently, they've picked up the odd kind of university seat like Cambridge or occasionally and Oxford West. But London was for long completely dead to the party. Simon Hughes was the only third-party MP. And then, of course, they did develop that little redoubt in the southwest.
Yeah,
in Kingston and Richmond, etc. But that, was it. But in the 20s, in the European Parliament election this year, the Liberal Democrats were stronger in London than anywhere else. This is a complete reverse of the party's traditional electoral geography. So the implication of that is that, sure, if there's going to be a surprise anywhere for the Liberal Democrats, it's probably going to be not very far from here. Mm. But the obverse of that is actually their chances of winning places like St Ives, North Devon, North Cornwall, which are traditionally strong places for them, given how pro-Leave those places are, it's going to be quite a considerable challenge for them. So they may end up changing the character of their geography quite substantially.
But so, or a seat like Greg Hands in Fulham, where there seems to be a Liberal Democrat surge happening there. But it's possible then that they don't end up with that many extra seats.
No, sure, because there's upside and downside. I mean, basically, the 25 seats or so where they're closest, and that's a very wide definition then of close seat. I mean, they split roughly 50-50 in terms of whether they're Remain seats or Leave seats. So, given what we see in front of us at the moment, they should do better in their Remain targets than their Leave targets, and that indeed, given, for example, the fact that they've put up some very high-profile candidates in some constituencies in London, maybe that will generate the odd place where you would have said historically there wasn't a chance at all. But, given where they are in the polls at the moment across the country, I mean, I think the warning for hopefully anybody who lives and works in London realises that after the 2016 EU referendum, this place is atypical. And there may well indeed be some quite interesting developments for Democrats going on in West London. London is not the rest of the country, right? And given that the opinion polls are showing them having slipped a bit, they're at 14%, then, if they're doing well here, they're doing jolly badly somewhere else.
Well, I was going to ask you whether London really matters then. I mean, there's so many other interesting parts of the country as well.
If you're the Liberal Democrats and you have managed to land, your signal achievement in the last parliament was to persuade a load of MPs from other parties, from both other parties, to switch in your direction. You would like kind of to hang on to some of them, because some of them, at least probably any neutral observer would say, they're kind of a quite considerable asset.
Yeah.
So, and a number of those are fighting in this city, and you can understand, therefore, why the party but would if you, like to
if,
do well.
If you wind it back just a few months ago,
yeah,
there was, in centrist terms, great excitement about, say, 6 months ago, about new parties emerging, Change UK, which kept changing its name, various other phenomenon. And it sounds as though you're saying that unless something very quirky happens for them, there isn't going to be that kind of centrist breakthrough.
Well,
it's about the transition of seats between Labour and the Tories.
I will dispute your use of the term centrist here. The Liberal Democrats, for the purposes of Brexit, are an extremist party, right? They are in favour of revoking Article 50, OK? They are not centrist on the issue. They're as much out on the extreme at one direction as Nigel Farage is in the other direction. Of course, what, you know, the history, of course, of the earlier part of this year is sure. Change UK, the Independent for Change, decided to try to see if they could pitch a tent on what is classic Liberal Democrat territory. Now, the Liberal Democrats are classically a socially liberal party that gets people who, you know, love immigration, believe in PR, etc., etc. I think that European Union is a great thing. Mm. You know, that's their core constituency. And yeah, sure. Well, centrist stroke, somewhat variable in their position on the economy. I mean, they're now back to the, oh, let's increase income tax and spend a bit more on public services phase, as opposed to the, let's reduce income tax on or increase the personal tax thresholds so people paying less income tax and be on their more Orange Book phase. They tend to vacillate over time, all right? But in that sense, they're centrist if variable.
I was meaning centrist in terms of somewhere between John McDonnell and Boris Johnson.
In those terms,
they're centrist.
On the left-right dimension, they are centrist. But the point.
But on Brexit, they're extremists.
Brexit is not about left versus right, okay? Left-wingers were as likely to vote for Brexit as right-wingers. UKIPers, people used to vote for UKIP, and now for the Brexit Party. I mean, Eurosceptics are not in love with international capitalism. They are looking for protection from international capitalism. And they are as distrustful as big business as they are of the state. And many of them are concerned about inequality. So on the left-right dimension, many of them are, you would classify as being on the left. What they are is socially conservative. They are people who believe, they're uncomfortable about immigration, and they believe in the importance of having a degree of social cohesion in a society in order to make the society
clear. But surely, well, Brexiteers, and this might be part of the problem and might explain a bit of what's happened in the last couple of years, Brexiteers are divided within themselves as a movement, aren't they? Because there are some Brexiteers who are gung-ho for free trade deals with America, etc., and then others who are borderline protectionists.
One of the many disjunctures that Brexit's created is indeed within the Leave movement. So you're sure at elite level, and indeed, you know, the whole concept of global Britain, the idea is that, well, actually, the European Union is a relatively sclerotic institution that doesn't allow international capitalism to play out enough.
Yeah.
And we want this country to be able to do more in the way of international trade and to be even more exposed to international trade flows. Well, one of the things that tends to come with international trade flows? Migratory flows. What was central to the Leave side of the argument? Please, could we have greater control over immigration? And more broadly, again, you know, what's the backdrop to this? The other backdrop to this is the way in which living standards have failed to increase, you know, in the last 10 or even more years. And so, you know, you're looking, the core Leave voter is somebody who is older, with less in the way of labour market skills, is somebody for whom immigration is something that happens to them because they don't have the skills to be able to profit from it, and who in many cases have received relatively the way of an improvement in living standards of anything at all and may still feel job insecure. These people aren't going, oh, great, can we create a Singapore on Thames? They are looking for protection, including things and aspects of labour market regulation. They're not looking for unfettered capitalism.
Now, let's take the two main parties. We've talked a lot about the Lib Dems.
Yeah, the small parties always tend to fascinate people, don't they? Yes.
They do, but Boris and Corbyn are pretty fascinating as well.
Yeah, sure.
So this picture you describe of the Conservatives swapping some of their support in areas which would have been traditionally Tory, and they are developing support in places that people would have once thought impossible.
Yeah.
If it goes wrong for the Tories on December the 12th, How does it fail to work for them? What goes wrong with the strategy? Is it that they don't make the breakthrough again in those kind of seats, Bishop Auckland, etc.?
Yeah.
But and they are simultaneously hammered in Wimbledon, Fulham, and they do worse in the southwest than they anticipate. How does it happen?
Well, I mean, I think I'd look at it differently rather than looking at initially through the frame of geography. So, Boris Johnson's signal achievement has been to unite the Leave vote. That's what he set out to do. He's now got 2/3 of the Leave vote. The Brexit Party has been heavily squeezed. And it's that concentration that gives him the one of the two crucial steps to be able to win the election. But the other side of what he has to worry about is what happens on the Remain side of the argument. And that's something over which he has less control. So there are two ways, in a sense, in which things could go wrong, given that structure. One is that the Liberal Democrat vote falls back further, that the Labour Party, as a result, advances more, i.e. the Remain vote begins to concentrate. That's something over which Boris doesn't have any control, but he doesn't want to happen.
And that happens because voters start to decide that it is, as you described earlier, so a binary choice.
There are two ways that can happen, of course. One is that simply across the country as a whole, Jeremy Corbyn again, wows the crowd and persuades Remain voters that he really does have their interests at heart, and therefore, the Labour Party's back to over 50.
There's some people laughing here.
I know. Well, you have to lay out the hypothesis. And the over 50% of Remain voters decide to vote for the Labour Party, as indeed they did in 2017, all right?
Yep.
Or, of course, the campaigns to try to organise tactical voting are so successful that actually, they cost the Tories 10, 15, 20 seats, and that is enough to make the difference. And that, again, is something over which Boris has no control. So the two ways in which the Remain vote could organise itself. So that's risk number one on the Remain side. The second thing, of course, is he does need to want to hang on to the around 18 or 19% of the Remain vote that is still going to vote for the Conservatives, which, sure, the Liberal Democrats in particular, I think, would love to pry some of it away from. But he needs to hang on to that, right? So to give you some idea, at the moment, if you were to ask me, how would the Conservative Party be likely to win Workington? I would say, look.
As you should expect, so Workington is this blue-collar seat that would be a traditional Labour seat.
Yep. The point is, it's one of a number of Labour marginals that has never voted Conservative in a general election. It has done in a by-election, but not in a general election. And it voted for Brexit, and it swung to the Tories in 2017, right? OK. Now, there is a relatively simple way in which the Tories can win Workington, and that is just do as well as they did there last time. We know that in Labour Leave seats, about 60% of the Labour vote voted Remain. Right? It's not a Leave vote. Some of the Remain voters in Workington, like some of these other seats, switched to the Democrats. Bingo, the Tories are home. Without necessary, and sure, I mean, if that happens, of course, and here's a risk. If indeed the Tories do pick up some of these seats, doubtless somebody will go around and say, there's been a major social transformation and Boris has been able to reach parts of the electorate that the Tories have never previously been able to reach, which will be completely wrong. All that will have happened is that Boris would have been able to take advantage of Theresa May's legacy, because that will be Theresa May's achievement, not Boris's. And it will not represent any social transformation. It will simply represent the consequences of the split in the Remain vote in those constituencies like everywhere else. So that's why thinking about what's happening on the Remain side is so crucial, because the more the Remain vote is split, even in places like Workington and Ashfield and Bishop Auckland, the easier it is for the Tories to win, even if they don't themselves make any great progress.
But isn't there something happening in class terms? Because people always say, well, we now live in the in the era of cultural politics rather than class politics.
But class is the wrong frame.
But he's winning.
Yes.
If YouGov are correct, he is winning among working class voters in a way that class, Theresa May didn't.
But social class is not the issue here, right? Brexit is about social liberalism versus social conservatism. Okay, whether or not you're somebody who says that, you know, I think it's up to people to decide for themselves what moral code they follow, what social mores they follow, what symbols they adhere to and recognise, what national identity they have, what religion they follow, what language they speak, etc. And by the way, I love living in London, which is this wonderfully diverse city. Social conservatives, in contrast, say, no, look, actually, if a society is going to cohere, then actually society does need to impose a common moral code. Actually, people do need to acknowledge the Queen and the flag. They do need to speak English, etc. There's a requirement for a certain degree of social mating. And by the way, frankly, I think this country's got a bit too diverse. So they hate
London.
And that's what it's about. Now, the point is that the demographic division on that divide, A, it's about age, right? Yep. It's young people versus old people. But secondly, it's about educational background. It's about educational background rather than social class. Now, of course, the point is the graduates voted very strongly to remain. Those who have less in the way of educational qualifications were more likely to vote leave. Now, not least because they have different real interests about immigration, right? It's young people and graduates who have the ability and the labour market skills to profit from freedom of movement. And old, right. So the point is, that's what is the debate. Now, of course, the knock-on effect of the fact that the Remain cause is a middle-class, i.e. graduate cause. So the fact that it's a graduate cause makes it a middle-class cause. And the fact that Leave is predominantly something that those who have less than their education qualifications believe in makes it more of a working class course, but it's the educational background that's the stronger marker and determinant.
Let's talk a little bit about Labour, and we'll come on to the personalities of the leaders in a second.
Sure.
But just talk us through where Labour is positioned, because if you're looking for a Labour revival, I mean, it's quite difficult to see where it comes geographically. Labour's in real trouble in Scotland.
Yeah.
Seems to be in trouble in Wales.
Yeah. It's
under pressure, as you described.
Yeah, well,
in the northwest and the northeast.
Yeah.
It's got problems in London.
Yeah, the Labour Party's only at 30% in the opinion polls, ergo, which is 11 points down on last time. Ergo, the Labour Party has problems pretty much everywhere. If your vote's down that much, inevitably you have a problem.
And what's driving it? Is it primarily Corbyn? Because some of the polling evidence suggests that Labour particular policies are popular.
Yes, I mean, I would make three remarks on that. The first is that on domestic issues, the Labour Party has some policy positions that are popular, not least with respect to the nationalisation of utilities, involving workers more and boards. On the other hand, you know, when it comes to health, the differences between the parties are pretty narrow. And of course, what's also true, and one of the things that makes life more difficult for Labour, is that everybody now has a magic money tree, and you know, the Tories are saying we're going to spend more, so it becomes much more difficult for the Labour Party to distinguish themselves on that issue. They just simply, you know, our money, big money tree is bigger than your big.
What's going to happen when, after the election, whoever wins, it becomes apparent that there isn't a magic money tree?
Well, that's for them to worry about at the next election rather than at this one.
But so anyway. There is. So my thesis that the Tories could conceivably win and then 92 style be spectacularly unpopular in 6 months or a year.
If you don't mind delivering. And obviously, there are question marks about your ability to raise capital public spending without also raising current spending, because, you know, how it's great to have to build, even if the new hospitals do actually exist. And
yeah.
Of course, that's the matter of dispute. You've got to put doctors and nurses in them, and that requires current spending.
Now, tell us a bit about Corbyn.
So point one is that Labour have some relatively popular policies, though in some of the areas that they're constrained. The second thing, of course, however, is that on Brexit, the Labour Party is still clearly in trouble, because at the end of the day, you know, they're still trying to appeal to both sides of the argument, but voters just say, we don't understand, right? So it becomes very difficult for Labour to compete on that. But I think the third real problem is this, and it's kind of wider than Corbyn, it's that people are not convinced the Labour Party can deliver. And I think, you know, this is illustrated most starkly, if perhaps in a somewhat exaggerated fashion. When Delta Poll, keep on now asking people...
That's one of the pollsters, yeah.
Yeah, one of the pollsters, right? And they're not just simply asking which party do you think is best at X, they're actually asking, look, who do you think would be best for running the economy? Is it Boris Johnson and What's the current, what's the new Chancellor of the Exchequer?
Sajid Javid. Changes all the time.
Or John McDonald and Jeremy Corbyn. And, you know, people just go, you know, Johnson and Javid. But then even on health, is it Johnson and Hancock and Corbyn and Ashworth? And the answer is Corbyn. It's Johnson.
And the other bloke.
Sure.
But
and Hancock. So the point is, it looks as
which is an extraordinary turnaround.
Yeah, sure. Now, when you ask a bit about parties on health, which party trusts on health,
and values, still ahead a bit, they're still Labour's still trusted.
But not by that much. So Labour's problem seems to be that people are not convinced that it can deliver, right?
But is that...
And that does come back, obviously, to...
The personality of the leader.
Well, not so much the personality, perhaps, but it's the perceived leadership ability of the leader, right? So again, think of the contrast that YouGov came up last night with in the wake of the debate and their instant debate. Who do people like? Well, they kind of tend to like Jeremy Corbyn, but who do they think is prime ministerial? Well, you know, it's Boris Johnson. Mm. So it seems to be the qualities that are central to the ability to provide leadership. And I think most kind of observers will say, like, you know, Jeremy Corbyn's had a wee bit of a problem about leadership in the last 2 years, i.e., you know, how the party's position on Brexit has kind of evolved in a somewhat difficult and convoluted fashion, and the way in which, indeed, you know, whatever the merits and arguments of the case, the perception is that the issue of the anti-Semitism has not been adequately closed down.
Yeah.
Those are litmus tests that make people go, hang on, not quite sure he can run the country.
But his personal polling numbers are terrible.
Yeah, well, yes, his personal polling numbers, the position is as follows. Jeremy Corbyn is now the most unpopular leader of the opposition ever, and he starts off this election in an even slightly worse position in terms of approval, disapproval, than was the position in 2017. But Boris Johnson is the most unpopular new prime minister ever, and he is still not as popular as Theresa May was at the end of the 2017 campaign. So shall we say the laughs at the... in the leaders' debate last night, were illustrating a wider story. Both of these gentlemen have a problem.
But Jo Swinton's catching up. She's getting really, really unpopular as well, isn't she?
Yep. Well, I certainly agree with you that she's certainly not managing to improve her popularity.
No. We're going to go to some questions in a second. I just wanted to ask you quickly first about Scotland.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, so we first worked together, I think, in 97 or 99 with the Scottish Parliament elections on Sunday.
Yeah.
And Scotland is, it's highly unusual. There's almost a different election happening there. Can you explain to us a bit about why that matters? It's a different contest. And the arguments we've been having about Tory versus Labour don't really even apply there.
No.
And there are a lot of seats at stake.
Yeah, okay. I mean, the first thing you have to realise is that the so-called British two-party system is now an English and Welsh one. The two-party system was destroyed in Scotland in the wake of the 2014 referendum, and the SNP are dominant. Point one. Point two, you have to understand, is that Scotland is literally full of marginal seats. I mean, there's only about a dozen or so where the lead of the largest party or the second party is more than 10 percentage points, and most of the ones that are left are ones where it's not much more than 10 percentage points. So in theory, at least, Scotland could move dramatically in one direction or the other. If there were to be a swing against the SNP, they could lose a barrowload of seats. But conversely, if there is a swing to the SNP, they will potentially recapture quite a lot of what they lost in 2017.
And the early indications are the Tories are doing, at the moment, slightly better than they thought.
Well,
slightly, but based on the YouGov samples.
Based on looking at the detailed samples, yes. We've not had separate Scottish polling since the middle of October, but life's moved on. But basically, the SNP's vote is at least holding up and is probably a bit stronger. The Labour vote it's down everywhere, so it's down in Scotland. The party could lose every single one of the six seats that they regained last time. You're right, it looks like perhaps the picture for the Tories is a bit better now, but their vote is still probably down, and so therefore, given that a number of their seats are marginal, they're still at risk of losing things. So certainly at the moment, at least, one would expect, even if the Democrats go towards the higher end of expectations, and maybe their vote goes up, or maybe some of the seats around here go dramatically, at the moment the SNP would still be the favourites to be the third largest party in the next House of Commons.
Now we're going to have our first question, and I should point out that I did on television the other day on the BBC, I described Scotland as a marginal nation, which then meant I was deluged on Twitter with Scottish nationalists saying, see, you've rejected your country, it's not a marginal nation, we're really important. I said, no, full of marginal seats.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, who has the first question? We have microphone.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed it, do please subscribe to our website, which you can find at www.reaction.life. We have brilliant political coverage and commentary, and a fantastic weekend section, featuring writing on the arts, lifestyle, and the latest developments in literature, and we depend on subscribers. Our podcast with the editorial team comes out once a week, and I hope you will join us for our next edition.